Chapter 64. Florence Solitary and the Midshipman Mysterious. Florence lived alone in the great dreary house, and day succeeded day, and still she lived alone, and the blank walls looked down upon her with a vacant stare, as if they had a gorgon-like mind, to stare her youth and beauty into stone. No magic dwelling place in magic story, shut up in the heart of a thick wood, was ever more solitary and deserted to the fancy than was her father's mansion in its grim reality, as it stood lowering on the street. Always by night, when lights were shining from neighboring windows, a blot upon its scanty brightness. Always by day, a frown upon its never-smiling face. There were not two dragon sentries keeping ward before the gate of this above, as in magic legend are usually found on duty over the wronged innocents imprisoned. But besides a glowering visage, with its thin lips parted wickedly, that surveyed all comers from above the archway of the door, there was a monstrous fantasy of rusty iron, curling and twisting like a petrifaction of an arbor over threshold, budding in spikes and corkscrew points, and bearing, one on either side, two ominous extinguishers, that seemed to say, "Who enter here, leave light behind." There were no talismanic characters engraven on the portal, but the house was now so neglected in appearance, that boys chalked the railings and the pavement, particularly round the corner, where the side wall was, and drew ghosts on the stable door, and being sometimes driven off by Mr. Towlinson, made portraits of him, in return, with his ears growing out horizontally from under his hat. Noise ceased to be, within the shadow of the roof. The brass band that came into the street once a week, in the morning, never brayed a note in at those windows, but all such company, down to a poor little piping organ of weak intellect, with an imbecile party of automaton dancers, waltzing in and out at folding doors, fell off from it with one accord, and shunned it as a hopeless place. The spell upon it was more wasting than the spell that used to set enchanted houses sleeping once upon a time, but left their waking freshness unimpaired. The passive desolation of disuse was everywhere silently manifest about it. Within doors, curtains, drooping heavily, lost their old folds and shapes, and hung like cumbrous palls. Hecatombs of furniture, still piled and covered up, shrunk like imprisoned and forgotten men, and changed insensibly. Mirrors were dim, as with the breath of years. Patterns of carpets faded, and became perplexed and faint, like the memory of those years' trifling incidents. Boards, starting at unwonted footsteps, creaked and shook. Keys rusted in the locks of doors. Damp started on the walls, and as the stains came out, the picture seemed to go in and secrete themselves. Mildew and mold began to lurk in closets. Fungus trees grew in corners of the cellars. Dust accumulated, nobody knew whence, nor how. Spiders, moths, and grubs were heard of every day. An exploratory blackbeetle now and then was found immovable upon the stairs, or in an upper room, as wondering how he got there. Rats began to squeak and scuffle in the nighttime, through dark galleries they mined behind the paneling. The dreary magnificence of the staterooms, seen imperfectly by the doubtful light admitted through closed shutters, would have answered well enough for an enchanted abode. Such as the tarnished paws of gilded lions, stealthily put out from beneath their wrappers, the marble lineaments of busts on pedestals, fearfully revealing themselves through veils, the clocks that never told the time, or, if wound up by any chance, told it wrong, and struck unearthly numbers, which are not upon the dial, the accidental tinklings among the pendant lusters, more startling than alarm bells, the softened sounds and laggard air that made their way among these objects, and a phantom crowd of others, shrouded and hooded, and made spectral of shape. But, besides, there was the great staircase, where the lord of the place so rarely set his foot, and by which his little child had gone up to heaven. There were other staircases and passages, where no one went for weeks together. There were two closed rooms associated with dead members of the family, and with whispered recollections of them, And to all the house but Florence, there was a gentle figure moving through the solitude and gloom, that gave to every lifeless thing a touch of present human interest and wonder. For Florence lived alone in the deserted house, and day succeeded day, and still she lived alone, and the cold walls looked down upon her with a vacant stare, as if they had a Gorgon-like mind. To stare her youth and beauty into stone, the grass began to grow upon the roof, and in the crevices of the basement paving. A scaly crumbling vegetation sprouted round the windowsills. Fragments of mortar lost their hold upon the insides of the unused chimneys, and came dropping down. The two trees with the smoky trunks were blighted high up, and the withered branches domineered above the leaves. Through the whole building white had turned yellow, yellow nearly black, and since the time when the poor lady died, it had slowly become a dark gap in the long monotonous street. But Florence bloomed there, like the king's fair daughter in the story. Her books, her music, and her daily teachers were her only real companions, Susan Nipper and Diogenes excepted, of whom the former, in her attendance on the studies of her young mistress, began to grow quite learned herself, while the latter, softened possibly by the same influences, would lay his head upon the window ledge, and placidly open, and shut his eyes upon the street, all through a summer morning, sometimes pricking up his head, to look with great significance after some noisy dog in a cart, who was barking his way along, and sometimes, with an exasperated and unaccountable recollection of his supposed enemy in the neighborhood, rushing to the door, whence, after a deafening disturbance, he would come jogging back with a ridiculous complacency that belonged to him, and lay his jaw upon the window ledge again, with the air of a dog who had done a public service. So Florence lived in her wilderness of a home, within the circle of her innocent pursuits and thoughts, and nothing harmed her. She could go down to her father's rooms now, and think of him, and suffer her loving heart humbly to approach him, without fear of repulse. She could look upon the objects that had surrounded him in his sorrow, and could nestle near his chair, and not dread the glance that she so well remembered. She could render him such little tokens of her duty and service as putting everything in order for him with her own hands, binding little nosegays for table, changing them as one by one they withered, and he did not come back, preparing something for him every day, and leaving some timid mark of her presence near his usual seat. Today, it was a little painted stand for his watch. Tomorrow she would be afraid to leave it, and would substitute some other trifle of her making, not so likely to attract his eye. Waking in the night, perhaps, she would tremble at the thought of his coming home and angrily rejecting it, and would hurry down with slippered feet and quickly beating heart, and bring it away. At another time, she would only lay her face upon his desk, and leave a kiss there, and a tear. Still no one knew of this. Unless the household found it out when she was not there, and they all held Mr. Dombey's rooms in awe, it was as deep a secret in her breast as what had gone before it. Florence stole into those rooms at twilight, early in the morning, and at times when meals were served downstairs. And although they were in every nook the better, and the brighter for her care, she entered and passed out as quietly as any sunbeam, opting that she left her light behind. Shadowy company attended Florence up and down the echoing house, and sat with her in the dismantled rooms. As if her life were an enchanted vision, there arose out of her solitude ministering thoughts, that made it fanciful and unreal. She imagined so often, what her life would have been if her father could have loved her, and she had been a favorite child, that sometimes, for the moment, she almost believed it was so, and, borne on by the current of that pensive fiction, seemed to remember how they had watched her brother in his grave together, how they had freely shared his heart between them, how they were united in the dear remembrance of him, how they often spoke about him yet, and her kind father, looking at her gently, told her of their common hope and trust in God. At other times she pictured to herself her mother yet alive. And oh, the happiness of falling on her neck, and clinging to her with the love and confidence of all her soul. And oh, the desolation of the solitary house again, with evening coming on, and no one there. But there was one thought, scarcely shaped out to herself, yet fervent and strong within her, that upheld Florence when she strove and filled her true young heart, so sorely tried, with constancy of purpose. Into her mind, as into all others contending with the great affliction of our mortal nature, there had stolen solemn wonderings and hopes, arising in the dim world beyond the present life, and murmuring, like faint music, of recognition in the far-off land between her brother and her mother, of some present consciousness in both of her, some love and commiseration for her, and some knowledge of her as she went her way upon the earth. It was a soothing consolation to Florence, to give shelter to these thoughts, until one day it was soon after she had last seen her father in his own room, late at night the fancy came upon her, that, in weeping for his alienated heart, she might stir the spirits of the dead against him wild, weak, childish, as it may have been to think so, and to tremble at the half-formed thought, it was the impulse of her loving nature. And from that hour Florence strove against the cruel wound in her breast, and tried to think of him whose hand had made it, only with hope. Her father did not know she held to it from that time, how much she loved him. She was very young, and had no mother, and had never learned, by some fault or misfortune, how to express to him that she loved him. She would be patient, and would try to gain that art in time, and win him to a better knowledge of his only child. This became the purpose of her life. The morning sun shone down upon the faded house, and found the resolution bright and fresh within the bosom of its solitary mistress. Through all the duties of the day, it animated her. For Florence hoped that the more she knew, and the more accomplished she became, the more glad he would be when he came to know and like her. Sometimes she wondered, with a swelling heart and rising tear, whether she was proficient enough in anything to surprise him when they should become companions. Sometimes she tried to think if there were any kind of knowledge that would bespeak his interest more readily than another. Always. At her books, her music, and her work, in her morning walks, and in her nightly prayers. She had her engrossing aim in view. Strange study for a child, to learn the road to a hard parent's heart. There were many careless loungers through the street, as the summer evening deepened into night, who glanced across the road at the somber house, and saw the youthful figure at the window, such a contrast to it, looking upward at the stars as they began to shine, who would have slept the worse, if they had known on what design she mused so steady. The reputation of the mansion as a haunted house would not have been the gayer with some humble dwellers elsewhere, who were struck by its external gloom in passing and repassing on their daily avocations, and so named it, if they could have read its story in the darkening face. But Florence held her sacred purpose, unsuspected and unaided, and studied only how to bring her father to the understanding that she loved him, and made no appeal against him in any wandering thought. Thus Florence lived alone in the deserted house, and day succeeded day, and still she lived alone, and the monotonous walls looked down upon her with a stare, as if they had a gorgon-like intent, to stare her youth and beauty into stone. Susan Nipper stood opposite to her young mistress one morning, as she folded and sealed a note she had been writing, and showed in her looks an approving knowledge of its contents. "Better late than never, dear Miss Floyd," apostrophe said Susan, "and I do say that even a visit to the old Skidleases will be a godsend." Apostrophe, "It is very good of Sir Barnet and Lady Skettles, Susan," apostrophe returned Florence, with a mild correction of that young lady's familiar mention of the family in question, to repeat their invitation so kindly. Apostrophe, "Miss Nipper, who was perhaps the most thoroughgoing partisan on the face of the earth, and who carried her partisanship into all matters great or small, and perpetually waged war with it against society," screwed up her lips, and shook her head, as a protest against any recognition of disinterestedness in the Skidleases, and a plea in bar that they would have valuable consideration for their kindness in the company of Florence. They know what they're about, if ever people did, apostrophe murmured Miss Nipper, drawing in her breath. Oh, trust them Skidleases for that. Apostrophe, I am not very anxious to go to Fulham, Susan, I confess, apostrophe said Florence thoughtfully. But it will be right to go. I think it will be better. Apostrophe, much better, apostrophe interposed Susan, with another emphatic shake of her head. And so, apostrophe said Florence, though I would prefer to have gone, when there was no one there, instead of in this vacation time, when it seems there are some young people staying in the house, I have thankfully said yes. Apostrophe, for which I say, Miss Floy, oh be joyful. Apostrophe, apostrophe returned Susan, ah. This last ejaculation, with which Miss Nipper frequently wound up a sentence, at about that epoch of time, was supposed below the level of the hall, to have a general reference to Mr. Dombey, and to be expressive of a yearning in Miss Nipper, to favor that gentleman with a piece of her mind. But she never explained it, and it had, in consequence, the charm of mystery, in addition to the advantage of the sharpest expression. How long it is before we have any news of Walter, Susan? Apostrophe, apostrophe observed Florence, after a moment's silence. Long indeed, Miss Floy. Apostrophe, apostrophe replied her maid. And Perch said, when he came just now to see four letters, but what signifies what he says? Apostrophe, apostrophe exclaimed Susan, reddening, and breaking off. Much he knows about it. Apostrophe, apostrophe, Florence raised her eyes quickly, and a flush overspread her face. If I hadn't, apostrophe said Susan Nipper, evidently struggling with some latent anxiety and alarm, and looking full at her young mistress, while endeavoring to work herself into a state of resentment with the unoffending Mr. Perch's image, if I hadn't more manliness than that insipidest of his sex, I'd never take pride in my hair again, but turn it up behind my ears, and wear coarse caps, without a bit of border, until death release me from my insignificance. I may not be a Amazon, Miss Floy, and wouldn't so demean myself by such disfigurement, but anyways I'm not a giver up, I hope, give up. What? Apostrophe cried Florence, with a face of terror. Why, nothing, Miss, apostrophe said Susan. Good gracious, nothing. It's only that wet curl paper of a man, Perch, that anyone might almost make away with a touch, and really it would be a blessed event for all parties, if someone would take pity on him, and would have the goodness. Apostrophe, apostrophe, does he give up the ship, Susan? Apostrophe, apostrophe inquired Florence, very pale. No, miss, apostrophe returned Susan, I should like to see him make so bold as do it to my face. No, miss, but he goes on about some bothering ginger that Mr. Walter was to send to Mrs. Perch, and shakes his dismal head, and says he hopes it may be coming. Anyhow, he says, it can't come now in time for the intended occasion, but may do for next, which really, apostrophe said Miss Nipper, with aggravated scorn, puts me out of patience with the man, for though I can bear a great deal, I am not a camel, neither am I, apostrophe added Susan, after a moment's consideration, if I know myself, a dromedary neither. Apostrophe, what else does he say, Susan? Apostrophe, apostrophe inquired Florence, earnestly. Won't you tell me? Apostrophe, apostrophe, as if I wouldn't tell you anything, Miss Floy, and everything. Apostrophe, apostrophe said Susan. Why, nothing miss, he says that there begins to be a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.